Exodus chapter 18. Exodus 18, and our text is going to be starting in verse 13 and down to the end of this chapter. Today is actually our last message on Exodus that we will be having this year, because over the next few weeks I plan to preach on themes that are related to Christmas and also the new year. And later into January, we'll come back in chapter 19 of Exodus. But we are here in chapter 18. Actually, I'd like you to turn as well to a parallel passage to this. I'm going to be referring to that, and that is Deuteronomy chapter 1. Deuteronomy chapter 1. You can have a hand there, and we'll turn there in a little bit. But when we come to Exodus chapter 18, this really is, in God's providence, a natural place to pause our study for the holidays. Because it does come to the end of a section here, and chapter 19 is really on a different theme. And yet this passage is also an unusual one in the context of this book as a whole. It is the last of the transitional chapters between what the people of God experienced in Egypt and the Lord's work getting them out of there, between that and when at Mount Sinai the Lord establishes a covenant with this nation and gives them his law and sets up for his worship. These chapters are kind of sandwiched in between. And there is in these chapters, 16 through 18, frankly, a lot of material that is on the depressing side. Because you probably remember that a lot of this deals with problems that Israel faced along the way in the desert, and especially with their complaining against Moses and against the Lord in those circumstances. And yet there have also been some uplifting spots. I think particularly of the end of chapter 17, where we have this amazing story how this inexperienced nation defeated the Amalekites who attacked them. And then we also have the beginning of chapter 18. You read a little bit about that this morning, but it's the story of Jethro meeting up with Moses and the Israelites, hearing about all the amazing things the Lord had done, Moses proclaiming the great and mighty works of the Lord, and Jethro responding in faith and in worship. It really is a high point among the stories of Exodus. And today we're looking at the second part of this chapter. Jethro is still here. He is still playing a leading role, but the nature of this, the focus of this, is going in a lot different direction from what has been. And you, I'm sure, picked up on that as the passage was read. But the essence of what Jethro is doing, we could summarize it by looking at one statement in verse 18. So I direct you to verse 18 as he is talking to Moses. I'm sorry, verse 19. And he is beginning to encourage him. And he says right at the beginning of that verse, "Now obey my voice, I will give you advice." A father-in-law giving a son-in-law advice. I don't know what kind of associations come to your mind when you think about your relationship to your in-laws and this kind of advice. But that is basically what's going on throughout the chapter here, the section here. Actually, it is the first time in the Old Testament that we find the Hebrew word for advising. It shows really the life-changing and, in this case, nation-impacting effect that good advice or good counsel can have. I wonder if your life at some point took a decisive turn for the better because someone gave you a piece of good advice and you acted on it. Here's one example, and it comes from the life of a self-made millionaire. He says, quote, "During my recovery from a near-death cycling accident, I struggled with many life isn't fair moments. Instead of feeling grateful to be alive, I was bitter and angry. At 33 years old, I thought I was at the prime of my life and worried who I would become after I recovered. When I unloaded my frustrations on a mentor, he told me, quote, "All events in your life are neutral until you label them." All events in your life are neutral until you label them. Nothing has meaning until you give it meaning. And he's not talking about books or texts. He's talking about what you make of the circumstances of your life. And the man goes on to say, this shifted my perspective and showed me the possibilities. Even though things looked dark and difficult, I had a choice. I could be a victim or use the opportunity to create a better version of myself and inspire others. So it's the choice between going on in life with a negative victim mentality to how can I use this, how can I leverage this to grow. He said that advice helped me reach the corporate executive suite and now helps me inspire other corporate leaders to shift their perspectives and see the possibilities. You may not know this name, but those are the words of Michael O'Brien, who is an executive business coach. He authored a book entitled Shift, Creating Better Tomorrow, and is the founder of Peloton Coaching and Consulting, as well as the Pace Line Leadership Academy. Now, that's coming from a secular perspective. It really would not take too much adjusting to frame that in a way that is in line with biblical principles. But either way, it shows the power of how one or two sentences of well-timed and to-the-point advice can make in a person's life and radically alter the direction that they're heading and the outcome of their lives. This is why self-help books and podcasts are so popular. It's why young people are always asking for a mentor. And it's why Proverbs is a favorite book among Christian people. People want practical advice based on real-world experience that is going to help them get ahead, whether that be in their relationships or their careers or their finances or whatever area of life. And that is the sort of thing that we find going on in this particular passage. Moses' father-in-law gives him advice about a significant challenge that Moses was facing at this early stage of Israel's history. And the Lord used it to address a very real problem. The advice had to do with a better way for Moses to manage his responsibilities as the leader of God's people. And so that brings us to the theme of the message this morning, advice for administering God's work. Advice for administering God's work. Now we can break down this passage into six simple but vital pieces of advice. There really is a great deal of wisdom here, both in terms of what Jethro actually says and all of the other material that surrounds it in this passage. And you may think that this isn't very relevant for you because you're not in a leadership role, maybe like Moses was. It certainly has a lot of relevance for people in those kinds of positions and ministries. But I would say that no matter what your role in life is, no matter where the Lord has called you to serve, there is wisdom that we can all benefit from as each of us strives to be faithfully playing the part that the Lord has assigned for us individually. And the first piece of advice reflects the need that Jethro's advice is going to be addressing. It reflects the problem, or at least part of the problem, that needs to be solved at this particular moment. And I would just put it this way, very simply. It comes out at the beginning of the passage, but it's the background for the whole thing. And that is, Here's a piece of advice. Expect problems. When you're just making your way through life, or especially when you are striving to serve the Lord and play some part in His work, a lot of it comes down to your expectations of what you believe things are going to be like or feel like, or how people are going to respond to your ministry or to each other under your ministry. Expect problems. Look back at verse 13. The next day, Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood around Moses from morning till evening. When Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people, he said, "What is this that you are doing for the people? Why do you sit alone, and all the people stand around you from morning till evening?" And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a dispute, they come to me, and I decide between one person and another, and I make them know the statutes of God and His laws." As I read those words, particularly from the standpoint of a leader, my heart really goes out to this poor man. He had to persevere before any of this happened. He had to persevere through all of those tense interactions with Pharaoh, who was one of the mightiest men of the world at that time. And after that, he has to put up with the people's unbelief as they face Pharaoh's opposition in Egypt, but even right at the brink of the Red Sea. And then there was all of that complaining through the desert about the need for water and food. And most recently, out of nowhere, this attack from the Amalekites. This man was and had for a long time been under an enormous amount of pressure in leadership. And now we learn about another set of problems that really had not come up or been mentioned to this point. And that is, the Israelites cannot get along among themselves. Now, we want to be careful not to be too quick to criticize these people for having all these disputes that Moses is trying to figure out. I mean, you and I have a hard enough time sometimes getting along with the few members of our family while we live in an air-conditioned house and sleep in comfortable beds and eat out of a well-stocked refrigerator. But this nation, numbering probably somewhere around 2.5 million people, here they were living in these extreme circumstances after years and years of being slaves. Here they are now in these extreme conditions of a dry and dusty desert. Think about the potential for interpersonal relational problems. Think about the cantankerous attitudes that no doubt came out as people are dealing with their conflicts. Think about the potential for out-of-control tempers in responding to grievances between the Israelites. One writer imagines these examples. "She took my bucket and didn't return it. He dug a hole that my lamb broke its leg in. Those neighbors' kids stole my tent pegs. That guy broke my rake." Who knows what all the issues were in this particular circumstance. And if those kinds of things were on the list, on the agenda, they would be the more trivial sorts of problems. You would, I'm sure, end up confronting very serious things like slander, major theft, domestic violence, and adultery. Those are the kinds of things that later the law actually addresses and that God Himself gives instructions about how to handle, because these are the kinds of things that would go on. Folks, those are the realities of life in a fallen world, even among those who claim to be the people of God and should know better. And lest we think that that was the case and such a big problem here because this was Old Testament times and these people didn't have the whole Bible and it was a very early stage in God's plan of redemption. Lest we think that it was something unique to that era, I would just encourage you to pick up and read the New Testament epistles. How many of them were written to address sin problems in the early church? How many of them were directed at relational breakdowns among what we view as the sort of golden age of Christianity? I was listening to somebody, I think on a podcast the other day, talking about people had this hankering to go back to the early church, the glory days. And he said, well, which one would you like? Corinth? Galatia? Thessalonica? Or just read the first few chapters of Revelation? Really is not a whole lot different from the kind of tension that we see recorded in this passage. As long as you and I are this side of heaven, stuff is going to happen. And the sooner we accept that, the more effectively we can serve the Lord, especially if the Lord has called us to leadership among His people. Leadership is not just about being up in front of people. It is not just about leading in upbeat worship services. A lot of leadership is, frankly, about having awkward conversations. It is about the two or more sides to a story where you cannot figure out, for as hard as you try, you cannot figure out what actually happened. It's about the complicated conflicts where there is no straightforward solution and where the biblical teaching really does not address specifically what you're looking at. People are sinners and life is complex, and we ought to expect those kinds of problems to happen rather than be shocked by them. So expect problems. That's the reality that leads to the other advice that we're going to see. But if we're expecting problems and they come along, what do we do about it? How do we strive to be an influence for good in that kind of setting? And I would say part of it is our second point here, and that is pursue justice. Expect problems, and number two, pursue justice. That emphasis is implicit throughout this text. Neither Moses nor Jethro, as they're wrestling with this situation, neither of them takes this tack. Come on, folks. Just quit fighting. Get over it. This isn't that big of a deal. You people work it out among yourselves. Just chill out and don't worry about what someone else has done to you. It'll all work out in the end. That's not the approach that they take. Both of these men are committed to pursuing justice as best as humanly possible. And we see that come out especially in the parallel passage. And so I want us to look briefly at Deuteronomy chapter 1. Deuteronomy chapter 1, Moses begins to recount some of the incidents in that wilderness period and at Mount Sinai. And I'm going to pick it up at verse 9. He says, at that time I said to you, I am not able to bear you by myself. The Lord your God has multiplied you. And behold, you are today as numerous as the stars of heaven. May the Lord, the God of your fathers, make you 1,000 times as many as you are and bless you as he has promised you. So we're sort of getting some of the gaps filled in through the story of Exodus chapter 18, because we don't find those words recorded. In fact, here Jethro isn't mentioned, but this does seem to be talking about the same incident. And Moses is giving us more information about what he said on that occasion. And one of the things he says is that actually, in a sense, these problems are a result of God's blessing. You add more people to the mix, you can expect more problems, right? And so somebody might say, well, let's just have as few people as possible because we'll probably get along better. And in the flesh, I understand that perspective. But Moses says, no, may the Lord make you 1,000 times more. We have some problems, but in a sense it's a good problem because it comes about because God has kept his promise because of all of the seed that he told Abraham would come into the world. That's his spirit. It's really quite remarkable. And yet he says in verse 12, very honestly, how can I bear by myself the weight and burden of you and your strife? Choose for your tribes wise, understanding, and experienced men, and I will appoint them as your heads. And you answered me, the thing you have spoken is good for us to do. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and experienced men, and set them as heads over you, commanders of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, of tens, and officers throughout your tribes, and I charged your judges at that time. Hear the cases between your brothers, and judge righteously between a man and his brother, or the alien who is with him. You shall not be partial in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great alike. You shall not be intimidated by anyone, for the judgment is God's. And the case that is too hard for you, you shall bring to me, and I will hear it. And look especially at those last couple of verses. Moses is insistent that justice has to be done, that all the parties involved should be heard out regardless of their social status, that the judge ought not to play favorites or be intimidated by anyone. And why? He tells you why. He says, because the judgment is God's. In other words, those human beings are actually acting as representatives of God. They are speaking on his behalf. And therefore, they need to take these matters with utter seriousness. They ought to care deeply about justice because God is a God of justice. And folks, that continues to be the responsibility of leaders today. And we see that again in the New Testament epistles. The Apostle Paul does warn individuals not to take vengeance into our own hands, but he also teaches that God has instituted authorities, and part of their responsibility is to work out justice in their realm as best as humanly possible. In some areas, the role of justice falls to parents within a family. In other areas, it falls to the civil government that God has ordained. And yet, in other areas, church leadership has the responsibility of sorting through problems and conflicts and dealing with those things fairly. But whatever issue or whatever realm we're talking about, pursuing justice is an indispensable part of leadership. And that speaks more broadly to the role of leaders. As we see the responsibility that these men are to take upon themselves, we learn that leaders do not lean into the path of least resistance. They don't make choices simply on the basis of what is most likely to make them popular at the moment. They don't default to the decision or the direction that will be the easiest thing for them and their families, what will cost them the least. Leaders move toward problems, not away from them. That is the emphasis of Moses as he charges these men. Don't look for the easy way out. Don't look to profit personally from this. You move toward the problem, not away from it. Don't minimize what you're dealing with and strive for justice. And yet we understand that leaders are human too. They have a weighty responsibility, but they are not superheroes. They cannot do everything, and we all stand in need of help. I mean, we already saw that at the end of chapter 17, where Moses' only job was to lift up his hands so that the battle would be won, and even for that, he couldn't do it all himself. He needed people to come alongside and hold his arms up And we certainly see that here. And our third piece of advice gets to that. I could put it this way. Recognize limitations. Recognize limitations. Look at verses 17 to 18. Moses' father-in-law said to him, "What you're doing is not good. You and the people with you will certainly wear yourselves out, for the thing is too heavy for you. You are not able to do it alone." And if you could read that in the original language, you would see that the Hebrew, the wording there, is emphatic and it is repetitive. And it is not at all hard to imagine Jethro, as a caring father-in-law, getting rather exercised with a lot of emotion as he looks at his exhausted son-in-law and just says, "What in the world do you think you're trying to do here? This is ridiculous." He says, for example, "You will certainly wear yourselves out." And in that construction, the verb shows up twice in different forms to really drive home the point. And the verb that is used there, it's used in other passages of things like withering grass and withering leaves, which that's not a hard image for us at this time of the year. I mean, look around at the ground outside, at your backyard, and it is filled with dead leaves. And Jethro is concerned that Moses is going to end up like one of those leaves, shriveled up and useless because of overwork. Today we may not speak of it as leaves, but we use the image of fire and we speak about burnout. That is a candle that has used up all its wax, or a campfire that has burned up all of its fuel. And that's a danger for all of us, and especially those of us who are in leadership. Now the question is, how would you know whether you are beginning to burn out? I want to share with you some great answers, some very practical answers to that question from a book by an author named David Murray, and the book is entitled Reset, Living a Grace-Paced Life in a Burnout Culture. And as he's trying to help Christian people and Christian leaders assess their lives, he gives different categories that would open their eyes maybe a bit more to their actual condition. He has, for example, physical warning lights. And he says, you feel exhausted and lethargic all the time, lacking energy or stamina for sports or playing with your kids. Now, as he gets into this, we have to recognize that all of this, there's another side. Somebody has said that the world is run by tired people. And just because you're tired doesn't necessarily mean you're burnt out. But at some point, we do cross the line. And there is a physical component to it. He says mental warning lights. Concentration is hard. Distraction is easy. You think obsessively about certain difficulties in life. You forget things you used to remember easily. Emotional warning lights. You feel sad, maybe so sad that you have bouts of weeping or feel you're on the verge of tears. You feel pessimistic and hopeless about your marriage, your children, your church, your job, your nation. Relational warning lights. Your marriage is not what it once was. You don't delight in your wife as you once did. You are irritable and snappy at your wife and children. They view you as angry, impatient, frustrated, and critical. Vocational warning lights. You work more than 50 hours a week, although not very efficiently, productively, or satisfyingly. You have little joy in your work. You dread it, and you're so miserable that you would consider doing anything else but your present job. Moral warning lights. You view risque material on the internet, or have even graduated to using porn. Your expense account and tax return have some half-truths in them. Spiritual warning lights. Your personal devotions have decreased in length and increased in distraction, with little time or ability for meditation and reflection. You check email and social media before you meet with God each day. And now for those of us in pastoral ministry, pastoral warning lights. You are bored with the small stuff of ministry, thinking yourself above ministering to the seniors, the sick, and the time wasters. You're taken up more with your advancement than with God's name. And I just read a few. I mean, there's just a huge long list that was rather convicting and eye-opening. And it's the kind of thing that we need to be thinking practically about because of the very danger that Jethro is bringing up here, that Moses would certainly wear himself out and become useless if he continued in this mode. Now, it is clear from this passage and from the whole Pentateuch that this man was called, Moses was called to have a special role as a mediator between God and Israel. And with that, he was pointing ahead to this concept of mediation, a go-between, that the Messiah would one day work out ultimately. But what we're seeing here is that Moses had to come to accept this fact. He was not the Messiah himself. He was not the Messiah. And he shouldn't have a Messiah complex that made him feel like he had to have his hand in everything and had to personally fix everybody's problems. He had to accept his limitations as a finite human being. And that is a lesson that all of us have to learn before we break down and before we end up really limiting our usefulness. And in this case, the way that the Lord ordained Moses to learn a better way was actually through his father-in-law. And that brings us to the fourth bit of wisdom in this passage. And probably the thing that gets the most number of verses, and that is the concept of sharing responsibilities. That's the wisdom, the advice at this point, particularly verses 19 to 23, share responsibilities. Let's pick it up at verse 19. Now obey my voice. I will give you advice, and God be with you. You shall represent the people before God and bring their cases to God, and you shall warn them about the statutes and the laws and make them know the way in which they must walk and what they must do. Moreover, look for able men from all the people, men who fear God, who are trustworthy and hate a bribe, and place such men over the people as chiefs of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. Every great matter they shall bring to you, but any small matter they shall decide themselves. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this, God will direct you. You will be able to endure, and all this people also will go to their place in peace. There is so much common sense in the passage I just read. And it seems so obvious from our vantage point that we wonder why Moses had not thought about this already. And I would guess that it was probably because he was too busy. And he didn't have any time for reflection or for considering, am I approaching this all in the most effective way? What we're dealing with here is the simple concept of delegation. It is the sharing of the workload of ministry by dividing up responsibilities. It is the effort to get more people involved in this case, the administration of justice. And it's not that Moses was going to have a cakey life if he got some helpers. And it's not that he wasn't going to be doing anything or somehow surrendering his role. He actually would be enabled by this new approach to give better and more focused attention on the special role that only he could play in this nation. And this passage highlights that he did have a special role and that it wasn't just in resolving disputes, but it was actually involving the giving of, the imparting of, the teaching of God's revelation. Notice in verse 16, back there, he said, when they have a dispute, they come to me, I decide between one person and another, and I make them know the statutes of God and his laws. What that sounds like is that as new cases came up, and he really didn't have a lot of precedents to work from, as new cases came up, as difficult cases arose, Moses would go straight to God for the answer. God would lay down a law, and Moses would use that to answer the situation. Or maybe God had already spoken a word about that, and what Moses is doing is helping the people apply it to the problem that was before them, to their particular case. And Jethro recognizes that, and he highlights that role in verse 20, as he says, "You shall warn them about the statutes and the laws, and make them know the way in which they must walk and what they must do." And yet, even though he had that responsibility, and it did relate to disputes brought before him, the reality was there were plenty of, probably the majority of these were simpler cases that weren't that hard to figure out, or where other judges could figure out the application of God's law to the problems, and Moses was being encouraged here to hand off, to pass off the responsibility to these people. The point is, delegation is not just about making your life easier by passing on work to other people. It is about sharing responsibilities so that each person can concentrate on the thing that in God's providence he is most cut out for, the specific thing that God has called him or her to do in the work. I confess I've been watching a little bit of the World Cup lately, and I don't know a whole lot about soccer, but I do know this. No one player can be at the same time the goalie and a fullback and a striker and whatever other positions there happen to be. No one person can do all of those roles. A soccer team succeeds to the degree that each player is concentrating on his own position. And yes, they have to be coordinating their efforts, and they have to communicate with each other. But each person devotes his attention to the thing that he has been given specifically to do. Or you can think about the concert tonight. I'm not doing a whole lot in the concert, because I don't sing and I don't bake cookies. And you don't want me to try doing either of those, right? Each person concentrating on the thing that they've been most gifted of the Lord to do. And as we look on into the New Testament and try to apply this to the church, I want us to remember what the apostles said when they faced growing relational problems and material needs among the early church in Jerusalem. They said, "It is not right that we should give up preaching the word of God to serve tables. Therefore, pick out some helpers for that, because we are supposed to be devoting ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word." Same principle that you find in Exodus. And it comes out further as you start reading about the role of the elder. And why, for example, 1 Timothy 5:17 speaks of some of the elders in the group who labor specifically in preaching and teaching. In other words, there is a certain amount of specialization that enables the ministry to make progress as a whole. And on top of that, we could add what we've been talking about in Sunday school the last few weeks, that it's not just about elders and deacons, but it's about everybody in the church being gifted of the Lord to carry out some function or functions, each church member contributing to the growth of the body by focusing on the ministry that he or she has been especially enabled by the Spirit to do. Now, how do you know who does what and who is cut out for what? And there would be many answers to that question, but as far as what this passage tells us, we come to the fifth point, and that is assess qualifications. Assess qualifications. Verse 21 says, "Look for able men from all the people, men who fear God, who are trustworthy and hate a bribe, and place such men over the people as chiefs of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. And what becomes apparent is the job of the judge isn't given to just any warm body out there who needs something to do. And unlike the role of the priest and the king, this wasn't either something that you got by virtue of heredity or your family line. It says these need to be able men, literally men of capacity, which is a word that is used for people like Ruth and Boaz and the Proverbs 31 woman. It speaks about a clearly established ability or excellence in some area, and in this case, it is ability for making wise and just decisions. And yet the focus isn't primarily on that ability. It's actually on something deeper. In part, it's on their devotion. It says these ought to be men who fear God. And it's also on their character, that they would be men you can trust, who are not going to accept bribes or in any way pervert justice for personal benefit. And I wonder, going back to Acts 6, if the apostles had this passage in their minds when they said about those who would need to serve tables that they should be men of good repute, full of the Spirit, and of wisdom. And that concept of a leader's character, it is expanded on. When you come to read in the epistles about the elders and deacons, there's quite a list of qualifications in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus chapter 1 that would be like expansions on these concepts about qualifications that Jethro is bringing up here. In the nation of Israel, you had decision makers like these judges. In the church, you have decision makers like deacons and elders. In both cases, the Bible emphasizes their proven character and their proven ability for the ministries that they would undertake. And the way that you know about this in their lives is by observation of them, both their Christian life in general, as well as their efforts to minister, and all of that has to be assessed and established. And God uses the sense of God's own people regarding those things to show how he's leading when it comes to the appointment of leadership. So, assess qualifications. We have one more piece of advice in this passage, and it has to do with the way that Moses responds to what Jethro says. And that response makes this point: heed counsel. Heed counsel. Verse 24, so Moses listened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. Moses chose able men out of all Israel, made them heads over the people, thousands, hundreds, fifties, tens. And they judged the people at all times. Any hard case they brought to Moses, any small matter they decided themselves, and Moses let his father-in-law depart. He went away to his own country. Notice when Jethro sort of sticks his neck out to give this advice, notice the way Moses did not respond. Moses did not say, I'm not going to listen to my father-in-law. I mean, later on I'm going to write the book of Genesis. And like in chapter 2 it says, a man and a wife, right, they leave father and mother. And they are not under the authority of their parents anymore. And they establish their own lives in their homes. My father-in-law doesn't need to be giving me advice. Moses doesn't say that, nor does he say, who does this guy think he is? He's a Midianite, not an Israelite. He just showed up yesterday. What does he know? He doesn't have any of the experience I have with these people. In fact, he probably just got saved yesterday. What does he know about the ways of Yahweh? Moses doesn't say that. Moses doesn't say, does he not realize who I am? I'm the man of God, the anointed of the Lord. I don't need any advice. I'm God's special instrument. He's called me to be the leader and make decisions. I don't need other people to be giving me their opinions. Moses didn't say anything along those lines. In fact, at least in this passage, he didn't say anything at all. He just come to the conclusion, this is a good idea, and of course the Lord was involved in that. There's little hints here that God was leading through the advice of Jethro. There's no apparent deliberation. It just seems like the thing to do, and he immediately adopts this advice with a great deal of humility. Sadly, that kind of humility is not always characteristic of people who are in leadership. People may become leaders because they are perceived as strong and assertive, which can be good traits. But remember that Jesus taught that the leaders in his church are supposed to be servants. And a servant spirit includes the mentality that I actually don't know everything. I can learn from people. I can learn from people older than me. I can learn from people younger than me. It includes openness to the input of others and to the wisdom of people whose life experience may be helpful precisely because it is different from our own. And no doubt Jethro had dealt with situations in his past that helped him see what needed to be done in this moment. Moses had never read the book of Proverbs, but he was certainly living by what is taught in Proverbs 11:14, that where there is no guidance, a people falls, but in abundance of counselors, there is safety. No matter what position or what leadership role you and I may have, what the Bible does tell all of us is to nurture the humility that is willing to listen and to follow the good and wise advice of other people. You can learn that even from secular people, frankly, on some issues, but especially when it comes to the wise advice of fellow Christians whose thinking is shaped by the Word of God. So what have we seen this morning? What has been the advice for administering God's work? Expect problems, pursue justice, recognize limitations, share responsibilities, assess qualifications, and finally, heed counsel. Such is the wisdom that we glean from Exodus chapter 18. And somebody says, well, that's helpful, but what in the world does that have to do with Christmas? I'm glad you asked. And I want to remind you what I said a little while ago, and that is that Moses, in his role, was the God-appointed mediator between the Lord and these people, and that in that role, he was actually pointing ahead to the ultimate mediator between God and man. In fact, I want you to think about, as we close, a classic Christmas passage like Isaiah chapter 9. There we read that the coming Messiah is going to rule on the throne of David, and he is going to establish and uphold his kingdom with what? With justice and with righteousness. Our Lord Jesus is going to make everything right in the end. Your human leaders at some point are going to fail you, or they're not going to know what to do to make things right. Even in cases where that happens, those things that human authorities could never come to the best or right decision about, Jesus the King is going to make all things right in the end. And if you're supposed to be vindicated, who else would you want on your side but Jesus? He's going to vindicate those who need to be vindicated. And there is even a connection between Christ and Jethro. You remember that word for advice that I mentioned at the beginning of the message? The same root actually shows up in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. And among various titles for Jesus, it says he is going to be a wonderful counselor. Literally, a wonder of a counselor. That is, his counsel is going to be miraculous, supernatural. He's going to be a wonder of a counselor. He has perfect wisdom to guide us through life and into eternity. He has perfect wisdom to give us the counsel we need to know how to be reconciled with God and to know how to live for God and to serve Him in this world. In fact, He is the one who's been speaking to us through these passages, Old and New Testaments. This is God's own wisdom that reaches its climax in Christ. He has been the one that has been instructing us out of His treasury of wisdom. May the Lord help us to take it in, to apply it, to follow it, and to experience more of His gracious working in our lives and in our ministries. We're going to end by singing hymn number 566. Hymn number 566. A couple of stanzas of that, and it's a prayer that the Lord will